The machine will keep going, but the best thing to do, I think, is just ridicule them, expose their lies, and expose them for the frauds that they are.
Welcome, everybody. Alex Newman here. Thank you so much for being with us. Our guest today is Tim Hinchliff. He is the editor of The Sociable. He writes about policy, technology, how technology affects society, and he's got some really, really important articles. He actually beat everybody to the punch back in September, even before the United Nations announced that they were going to be doing all this wild stuff with digital public infrastructure and the 50 in 5 program. He was sounding the alarm. They've got some really, really significant articles at The Sociable, and it was actually very, very helpful to me as I was digging into this. Really amazing. It's September, October, they've got these things. The UN press release didn't go out until November. Tim, welcome to the program. Thank you so much. Let's start off with just the basics. What is this 50 in 5 program, and what is digital public infrastructure? Do we really need digital public infrastructure?
Well, thanks a lot for having me on, Alex. So digital public infrastructure, it's a concept that's been around for a while. And one of the big proponents of it is a guy named Nandan Nilekani. He was India's digital ID architect, Aadhaar. And he was also the co-founder of Infosys. But what digital public infrastructure basically refers to is it's a stack. It's digital identity, it's fast payment systems, and data exchanges. That's what it is on just basic bare bones. And so what the 50 in 5 campaign aims to do, that's the United Nations and Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's tagged and their partners. They want to roll out at least one component of that that stack in 50 countries within 5 years, so by 2028. And they already have, at the launch, which was in November of last year, they had 11 first mover countries, and I think they brought on at least one more. But so it's around a dozen or so is what they have right now.
Amazing. And some of these countries are, you know, obviously kleptocracies, rather poor third world governments. I'm sure there's money involved. I know the Norwegians are helping to finance this. I know Bill Gates is a big player. So let's talk first about Bill Gates. I mean, they're actually pretty open about the fact that Bill Gates is a critical partner in this. You don't have to dig very far to see that. You see a lot of these AstroTurf groups, these front groups that are supposedly helping to lead the way. They're funded by Bill Gates. They're partners of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. What is Bill Gates' interest in this digital public infrastructure? Is he just interested in helping humanity and all the things he claims, or is there a more nefarious purpose
here? Of course. Bill Gates is a philanthropist, and philanthropists, they all want to help out humanity. That's why he buys up all the farmland. That's why he invested so much in mRNA vaccines and technology and then dumped the stocks. So, yes, this is another one of his philanthropical endeavors. And it's not just, and if you look at who's involved in the 50 in 5 campaign, it's, you know, like we have all these partners, but if you look who funds them and who's partnered with who, they're all very much interconnected. So like they have the Center for Digital Public Infrastructure, which is backed by co-develop. These are people that are involved in 50 in 5. And also Nilekani Philanthropies, which is the same guy. Co-develop was founded by the Rockefeller Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and Nilekani and the Omidyar Network. Omidyar is a funder of MoSIP, which is another ID system that Togo is using, in which the Minister of Technology there said at the 50 in 5 launch that they were using MoSIP. And then the Digital Public Goods Alliance, which is another partner of 50 in 5, has both the Gates and the Rockefeller Foundations in its roadmap showcasing activities that advance digital public goods. So really, if you look at who's funding it, they're all basically the same people.
It's amazing. And it's not just on digital public infrastructure. You see this in so many different areas. Looks like there's this huge collection of organizations. They call it civil society. And like they're all funded by Rockefeller Foundations, Bill and Melinda Gates, same cast of characters. And in fact, they've been calling for this for a long time. I reported almost a decade ago about the ID 2020 initiative, which, of course, the partners were Microsoft, Gavi, right, the Bill Gates front group to promote vaccines, and also the Rockefellers. So They've had this plan for a long time. You mentioned India. Let's turn to India. I did write an article when they first launched. They said they were going to give every Indian a biometric ID and that that was going to be essential for them to get their government services, their welfare, whatever. And so now Bill Gates is running around touting India as this great success story because everybody's got their digital biometric ID. What do you know about what happened in India, and should that really be the role model for free societies?
Man, the whole history of the digital ID, digital identity in India with Aadhaar, it's it launched, I believe, like just a little over a decade ago. And the one thing they did say about it was, and they still say to this day, is that it's voluntary. And so that, you know, you can choose to be a part of it or not. But then what started happening is that throughout the years, Indian government agencies and states and elsewhere started mandating it for certain things, like you said, to receive benefits. You need one, I believe, to open up a bank account. So what has gone on throughout the years is that each time there's been a government overstep trying to mandate it, there's been Supreme Court decisions to try to slow that down and push back on the overreach. But meanwhile, the daily life of citizens was getting to be very difficult without this. So even with all the back and forth between the government and the Supreme Court, more people started signing up for it because their lives were becoming miserable without it. So now, after how many years, 12 years or so, they claim to have 1.4 billion volunteers signed up to Aadhaar.
That's amazing. And I want to play a little clip of this individual that you're talking about, Nandan Nilekani. This is him last year at the B20 summit in India. And he's talking about this digital public infrastructure. And he's like, everybody needs all of this. So here he is.
Vaccination had to happen. The government built the Cowin platform, which allowed India to have 2.5 billion vaccinations in 2 years. And you could go anywhere in the country, get a vaccination. You got a vaccination certificate in real time, and you could show it anywhere you went, in India or abroad. And the data from this enabled real-time observability of how things were going. So digital technology and DPI has been fundamental to the fabric of India's development. And there are many other applications. India, for example, today has a completely digital tax system. So both our income tax and our indirect tax is completely digital. Everybody pays digitally, which is, again, advancement done under Finance Minister Sitaraman in the last 4 to 5 years. We have a very streamlined system on the roads with our FASTag. FASTag was built by the Highway Ministry, does 2.5 billion transactions a month, and all toll collection today is the same standard thing across the country. So the idea of digital infrastructure is now sort of occupied and taken root everywhere, and that's very important.
So the digital infrastructure has taken root everywhere. It was used to track COVID vaccines and all the rest of it. And here's another one with him talking about the tools of the new world.
If you think, what are the tools of the new world? Everybody should have a digital ID. Everybody should have a bank account. Everybody should have a smartphone.
Okay.
Then anything can be done. Everything else is built on that.
Because we were talking about this before we came onto the panel, the three basic things. A smartphone, a bank account, and a digital ID.
Yes.
That's where every nation.
In India, it's been named by the Prime Minister the Jam Trinity. Jandan, which is the bank account, Aadhaar, the ID, and mobile.
That shouldn't cost that much.
Oh, nothing. Peanuts.
Yeah, it's peanuts, right? Well, I, for one, am never going to have a smartphone. I like my little dumb phone. Thank you very much, Mr. Nandan. But we got about a minute left, Tim. What do we make of these comments?
It's just another way to build that digital virtual architecture, which is all about tracking, tracing, and controlling and monitoring behavior and modifying behavior as well. So if you, you need the digital ID so you can get the vaccine passport. If you don't have that, then you can't participate in society. What comes next? Carbon credits, social credit, whatever next crisis they declare, whether perceived or real, they can just do whatever they want with it.
When we get back on the other side of the break, folks, we're going to go more in depth onto what the world looks like if these digital public infrastructure folks get their way, and also how we might participate in stopping this or at least resisting it as best as we can. All right, folks, stay with us. We're going to be right back here with more from Tim Hinchliffe, editor of The Sociable, when we get back here on Conversations That Matter. Stay tuned.
Remember when the only uncertainty in news was the weather forecast? Now, our world is clouded by half-truths, misdirection, and gaslighting. The deluge of lies from leftist activists posing as journalists is unrelenting. At The New American, we hold fast to the timeless truths of our founders. Sanctuary in the storm. Visit thenewamerican.com today and get 25% off your subscription.
Tim, before we went to break, we were talking a little bit about what the world might look like if these people get their way. You mentioned total tracking, total surveillance, and ultimately control through, you know, your carbon footprint, your carbon allowance, and all the rest of it. What does the new world that Nandan was talking about look like if they get this digital infrastructure in place, if everybody is now forced to have a digital ID and pay with digital payments and all the rest of it?
Well, and on the surface, in theory, what they want is what they want us to believe is that it's all about convenience and about making our lives easier, and that things can be processed very quickly, payments and whatnot. But what it really is creating a digital prison, in my view, especially once you see what they have about. They talk about climate adaptability all the time in digital public infrastructure and also at that launch of the 15.5. And with these climate things, do you think of, you know, what's going on already in cities around the world, like the low emission zones? And then they talk about 15-minute cities. And so they start off by saying, for the convenience, everything you need is right there. So why do you need to go out? You can go out, and there's alternative routes. You can do these things, but maybe on these certain types of days or whatever. But if over time, that doesn't mean that can change. Because over time, they're saying, well, no, you need to stay there. Why are you leaving? You know. So these things can turn very Orwellian very quickly, especially since digital identity is central to everything. That traces everything you do, what's going on, links you click, what websites you visit, what goes on in your bank account, what goes on with what you say on social media, and especially with the one they keep pushing overall is those carbon allowances, carbon emissions. So right now they're all about tracking, saying, hey, you can keep track, you know, banks do this, keep track of your carbon output, your carbon emissions. Isn't this a fun little tool? And that's quickly going to turn into a method of control as well, keeping you locked down, digital prison, whereas if you don't comply with whatever is going on, then they can just shut you off with a flick of a switch.
Yeah, imagine that, folks. So you're too critical of the new regime. You don't like your carbon allowance. You think it's not big enough. Well, we'll just shut you off, right? Now, one of the things that you linked this to, Tim, that I think is really critical for people to understand is the 15-minute city. This concept that, you know, you're going to have like a little invisible fence around you, like your dog in your yard, and you can't go outside of it without permission. Now, right now, it would be very difficult to enforce that because, of course, we're not, at least in theory, being tracked everywhere we go. We don't have to ask permission. But they're moving rapidly toward these smart cities, these 15-minute cities that are going to gather all sorts of data and control you. Talk a bit about 15-minute cities. What's so dangerous? And by the way, folks, these are already, the mainstream media in my state of Florida was talking about how they were going to rebuild some of these cities and towns that got hurt by the hurricane as 15-minute cities. So these aren't like some thing way off in the future. These are coming now. But Tim, talk to us about 15-minute cities. What is the danger? How does the digital public infrastructure support that concept? What do we need to know?
Because, you know, I like the convenience of having things, you know, near to you, but it's about the freedom of choice and being able to travel about, mobility, move around. So in a 15-minute city, especially a 15-minute smart city, that's the IoT, the Internet of Things. There's going to be sensors everywhere, cameras everywhere, pinging everywhere you go. So, and the whole push towards electric vehicles, you know, they want to eliminate, well, private driving in general. But the push for electric vehicles is because, and the World Economic Forum is involved in this as well, as the notion of battery passports. They want these types of digital IDs for not just people, but for the things. So anything you use is going to have like this little timestamp thing in tracking and tracing where you go. So it's more of a whole surveillance thing, Big Brother just peering into every intimate detail of your life. And with the coming metaverses, you know, in years to come, all your augmented reality, if you have one of those glasses on, anywhere you go, what you see is being recorded, that's going into that data, that information, that can be inside your house, that can be anywhere else. So you know, I don't mind if the doctor and the grocery store are really close by, but I would love to have freedom of choice.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's what this is about, right? The idea that the government and the public-private partnerships will tell us where we can go, when we can go, what we can eat, what we can buy. And folks, all this links together, right? The central bank digital currency is a critical part of the digital infrastructure that we're talking about here, is absolutely tied to this. In your article, Tim, one of your articles, you bring in some of these videos. We've actually talked about them on this program here before, too, where they're talking about how they're going to use these currencies to even control what you can buy. I'm going to play a quick clip of Eswar Prasad. This was at the Summer Davos in the for the World Economic Forum. And he's talking about what CBDCs will be useful for in terms of programmability.
The one final note I will make is that if you think about the benefits of digital money, there are huge potential gains. It's not just about digital forms of physical currency. You can have programmability, you know, units of central bank currency with expiry dates. You could have, as I argue in my book, a potentially better, and some people might see it, or a darker world where the government decides that units of central bank money can be used to purchase some things, but not other things that it deems less desirable, like, say, ammunition or drugs or pornography or something of the sort. And that is very powerful in terms of the use of a CBDC.
Yeah, I'll say that's pretty powerful. You're going to determine what people can buy, when they can buy it, and all the rest of it. What's going on here, Tim? I mean, the Chinese social credit score system is what comes to mind here, right? Because obviously, if ammunition is for sale, some people will be able to buy it. Some people will be able to buy those things, but other people won't. So how is this system that's emerging going to differentiate between, like, the good slaves who are allowed to, you know, say, travel where they want, the important people, the VIPs, and maybe the less desirable humans who maybe ask too many questions on social media or have friends like Alex Newman that are, you know, putting information out that's contrary to the narrative? What do you do?
Well, this what they say about programmability, yeah, it's either they'll restrict it or you make it super expensive. So, like, you want to buy ammunition or something like that, they'll just tax the hell out of you. But the case with this is, and you'll hear this from European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde. She's a doozy. But she has come out and said that, she's a piece of work, that central banks have no interest in programming CBDC. To her, she said, and to all central banks, that'd be a voucher. But then she said programmability would be for the intermediaries, the commercial banks. So it's kind of a way. So what's going on in the EU with their whole CBD, the digital euro thing? They're saying it's not going to be programmable. Well, it will be. It's not programmable by maybe the central bank isn't doing it, but the other ones will be. So yeah, programmability. It's not just about putting restrictions or taxing what you can buy. It's also where you can buy it. Like if it's because a CBDC cannot exist, it needs a digital ID. So that's pegged to you. So it can also say you can't buy anything without outside the certain radius. And it also comes in India they're exploring with the digital rupee expiry dates. So yeah, it's just like the central bank can issue digital money. Okay, that's what it is. But as soon as it gets to the intermediaries, then they can program wherever they, however they like, to completely control everything about your life.
And this is what they're talking about. You've already exceeded your carbon footprint. You can't eat any more steak. You can't fill your car up with gasoline anymore. I mean, they're talking about these things openly, ladies and gentlemen, and we need to recognize that they are serious. We're down to just a few minutes left, Tim. I want to leave people with some concrete ideas. How do we resist? How do we fight back if we don't want to live in a giant digital gulag built by the UN and Bill Gates?
Well, I wish I had all the answers. One thing that I'd like to do is to spread information awareness like we're doing right now. Another thing, you know, if I'm not too excited about politics at all. I try to keep that out of things. So, I mean, voting, yeah. What I see in the United States, I'm kind of hopeful about is, you know, some states are saying no to digital ID. Some states are saying no to CBDC. So that's fine. But I guess it's more about finding community, you know, and like-minded people and trying to connect with them and maybe even create parallel economies or whatever, something that's completely separate from what is going on and just resisting. You know, I live in Colombia, you know, in South America. I live up on a mountain and I prefer to be away from the cities and in paying cash everywhere. So, and there's these all these little things to try to be as self-reliant, independent as possible. And then and in that way, you can once you help yourself, you can help others out. Yeah, but as the machine will keep going, but the best thing to do, I think, is just ridicule them, expose their lies, and expose them for the frauds that they are.
Excellent. Couldn't agree with you more, Tim. Excellent advice there. And I tell people, you know, go meet your local farmers. Stop shopping at the big box stores. Use cash as much as you can. Now, these are all really, really simple things. They may not be the most convenient, but definitely will pay dividends in the long term. Tim, we're just about out of time. We're down to about 30 seconds left. Tim Hinchliffe, editor of The Sociable. You can find them at their website, sociable.co. Where else? You got a great Twitter page. How can people follow you? We've got about 10 seconds left.
Yep, at Tim Hinchliffe on Twitter, Getter and Gab.
Folks, go follow him, go check it out, go check out sociable.co. Also, go to thenewamerican.com, sign up for our free daily headlines. You can also subscribe to the print magazine. We appreciate you tuning in. Tim, thank you for joining us today. Folks, thanks again for all that you do for freedom. We appreciate you. Until next time, God bless you all.
Sophia paused before the door. It read, Department of Bi-Digital Convergence. Just inside was a new world, a better world, the one of everlasting life, of no pain, of no loss, of no problem. She entered the chamber and her surroundings changed. She saw around her an infinite field of waving golden grain surmounted by cloudless blue sky. The AI voice whispered gently in her mind, Welcome to the Singularity. She couldn't see it and couldn't feel it, but her body had almost instantly been covered by a swarm of tiny gray multi-legged bots that melted through her clothes and into her skin. Not perceiving the nightmare, her eyes had already been consumed and the rest of her body was dissolving as the bots digested her flesh. She felt only a warmth suffusing her being. Drowsy, she drifted to sleep, and her last thought was one of panic. Would she ever wake? Could a nightmare vision like this be an outcome of the much-hyped transhumanist technological singularity? Enter the world of the future as illuminated by the experience of the past in Endgame. The new book by Dennis Barrett, the publisher of The New American Magazine, and find out how the disastrous COVID pandemic response fits with the technocratic elite's thirst to create a transhumanist utopia. Get Endgame from shopjbs.org with free shipping with code ENDSHIP, ENDSHIP. Or get Endgame and the Great Reset Collector's Issue of The New American Magazine and get free shipping plus an additional 20% off both with code N20, END20.